Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's Friday, and that means it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. On today's Your Call, we're discussing coverage of Edward Snowden's NSA leaks and Ukraine's changing political landscape in the aftermath of the bloody protest crackdown, which led to the ouster of President Viktor Yanukovych. Luke Harding is an award-winning foreign correspondent with The Guardian. He's reported from Delhi, Berlin, and Moscow and has covered the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya. He is the author of The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man, and Luke just returned from eastern Ukraine. Hi, Luke. Welcome back to the show.
Rose, it's great to be with you again.
It's great to have you again. Well, as you know, Luke, on Friday, we always start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'd like to pay tribute to my colleagues who've been reporting from eastern Ukraine in very difficult circumstances. It's tough working there. You have to drive through roadblocks manned by men in balaclavas with Kalashnikovs who are often very hostile. And there's been some terrific reporting out of there. I liked Simon Ostrovsky's stuff very much, the reporter from Vice News who was kidnapped in Slavyansk and then released. And there was a great piece by my colleague, Sean Walker of The Guardian, from eastern Ukraine Today, where he's looking at some of the underlying causes of this kind of pro-Russian rebellion and talking about kind of poverty and lack of opportunity, which have as much to do with the conflict there as nationalism.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up because I wanted to start off today by talking about the challenges in reporting from Ukraine. The Committee to Protect Journalists, they're out with press releases almost every week about what journalists are facing. And they say that at least three journalists were shot last weekend and others were assaulted while covering deadly clashes between pro-Russian activists and their opponents in Odessa in southern Ukraine. And then there have been a number of reports about journalists being detained. Two Ukrainian journalists were detained. And then journalists from CBS News, BuzzFeed, and Sky News were detained and then released. So can you talk about the difficulties involved in reporting on the ground there?
Yes, Rosa, it's tough. And the underlying problem, I think, is that Russian propaganda has been absolutely at full volume. And essentially, the kind of Kremlin version of this conflict says that fascists backed by America have seized power in Kiev and that the people who oppose this huge growing separatist movement in the east are also fascists. But the problem is actually driving around eastern Ukraine, there aren't any fascists. It's a kind of fiction. There are ultra-nationalists for sure, but really not in the east. And so kind of journalists have become a kind of substitute, a sort of fascist substitute, especially if you're American or British. And so what's happened was that I was going very regularly to Slavyansk, which is this kind of military enclave where you have pro-Russian separatists, you actually have undercover Russian soldiers. And they are extremely hostile towards journalists. They've kidnapped about 40 people, including many Ukrainian reporters who went there to just try and do the news, who are being held in the police headquarters. And I stopped going, actually. I stopped going a couple of weeks ago because the risk of kidnapping was just growing all the time. I had one unfortunate incident where I got past a checkpoint, which was okay, but then encountered another very hostile guy with a pistol who told us to get out of town in pretty frank language and stood in front of our car and then punched the car, leaving a dent.
Wow.
And we basically reversed because you don't argue with someone with a pistol. And the problem is that people are very twitchy. Their heads are full of sort of Kremlin propaganda about spies and Western infiltrators. And this makes the job of journalism quite hard.
Simon Schuster was recently on NPR. He's a Time magazine reporter, and he talked about his experience in the Ukrainian village of Kostana Katova. I'm trying to get these words right.
Kostanyakova.
Okay, yeah, thank you. Almost. And he says that it came under the control of pro-Russian separatists. And he said that at one checkpoint, the only armed man, not in uniform but in a tracksuit, hit him on the head with the butt of his pistol. He says it wasn't clear then, and it's not clear in hindsight, whether this man was a, quote, terrorist, a freedom fighter, or just an average thug. So who are these people exactly? And how would you as a journalist describe them in your pieces?
Well, I mean, you have to be careful because obviously our job isn't to pick sides in this conflict. It's just to tell the story as it evolves and as Ukraine slides into a place which is darker and darker. Essentially, what you've got are pro-Russian separatists. They don't like the term, but in effect, what they want to do is to create their own breakaway state, which will have a close relationship with Russia. And what Kiev says is actually that the plan is pretty obvious, that Russia either formally or informally wants to exercise control over a huge swathe of territory in the south and east of Ukraine, which is Russian-speaking, and bring it under its dominion in the same way that it did with Crimea. Maybe not formal annexation, but something short of it. And it's true that there is a big pro-Russia mood in the east. There's a feeling that the government in Kiev seize power illegally, but actually most civilian people you talk to don't want secession. They don't want union with Russia, but there's a hardcore minority of people with guns, many of whom I would describe as thugs, who are really going to try and achieve this at the point of a Kalashnikov. And the momentum is very much with them. They've seized a whole series of government buildings across the east of Ukraine, including in Konstantinovka, where Simon Schuster got hit with a pistol. Mm. And there is some Ukrainian army there, but the Ukrainian troops are pretty beleaguered. And it's an ugly conflict, I have to tell you.
Well, stepping back for a bit, Luke, in terms of providing context for what's happening here, in the book you wrote, Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, you write about what it was like for you when you arrived in Moscow in 2007 to take up a new job as a correspondent for The Guardian. You write that within months, mysterious agents from Russia's Federal Security Service, the successor to the KGB, broke into your flat. You were tailed by men, bugged, summoned to the KGB's notorious prison. So you know the history of Russia. You've been there. You've reported there. What are your thoughts on the stories that we're reading by journalists who might be flying to Ukraine? I mean, are they giving the proper context? And do you think that the West is telling the story accurately?
I think broadly it is. My book, I was expelled from Russia in the end, at the end of this kind of gloomy KGB saga, which you talk about in 2011. And when my book came out, some people were saying, no, this is too depressing a take on the Russian government. But actually, I think now, following the annexation of Crimea, that the fact that Russia is basically ripping up the borders of Europe and using force to do so, I think most people realize that this is a what we're dealing with here is a deeply authoritarian state run by a paranoid leader who is prepared to use military means to get his way and who's essentially wants the countries around him to be subservient. And I think we have to tell it how it is. That's really very much how it seems. President Putin was in Crimea today giving a kind of victory speech. And as well as the military, what Putin is brilliant at is this kind of information war. So he's convinced Russians, and indeed some Ukrainians in the East, that what's happening in Ukraine is kind of like the Second World War being refought. The good guys, the Russians against the fascists, which is the Kiev politicians, Obama, and so on. I mean, it was quite extraordinary in Donetsk, the regional capital, walking through the headquarters of the Donetsk People's Republic, which is the separatist body, and there were numerous caricatures of Obama. Obama as Hitler, Obama as Yulia Tymoshenko with a braid. There were even racist caricatures of Obama. It's quite astonishing, this merging of what happened 7 decades ago with the Red Army and what's happening now in the modern world of 2014.
Luke Harding is an award-winning foreign correspondent with The Guardian. He is the author of Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia. He just returned from eastern Ukraine, and we're discussing media coverage of what's happening on the ground. And if you have any questions for Luke about what he saw there, what are you seeing in reports? Are you getting the context that you need? Do you have any questions about the background? What really strikes you about the reporting? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. And Luke, for people who haven't been following the reports very closely, how do you explain what's really happening on the ground and how this all unfolded?
Well, I mean, what happened in Kiev, you have to go back to that, was that Viktor Yanukovych, who was the president of Ukraine, he was elected fairly, took power in 2011, but in power he turned into this hopelessly kleptocratic leader who looted the treasury. He stole, we think, in excess of $35 billion, he and his immediate entourage, his family, turned Ukraine into a kind of very repressive place, squashing independent journalism, taking over TV stations, suborning MPs and so on. The trigger was that in November of last year, having negotiated an agreement with the European Union, he decided to tear all that up and accept basically a bribe, a loan of $15 billion from Russia. There were street protests. They were peaceful for weeks. And then in January and again in February, snipers started shooting people down in the streets. And one day in February, more than 100 people were killed. And he fled. He fled to Russia. The problem is that this is portrayed by the Kremlin as a coup by fascists back with the West. It wasn't a coup at all. I've met many of the people who are protesting. They are, that you know, by and large, decent, educated people who just wanted proper, accountable government. But what happened in the East subsequently was that there was a kind of counter-revolution where pro-Russian groups decided that they would do their own sort of their own revolution against the authorities in Kiev. And to be honest, what I've seen on the ground is I've met Russian soldiers who are there undercover. You ask them where they're from, and they made a little effort to deny it. They've been infiltrated into the East, have joined up with locals, and really are creating mayhem. And Putin's game plan, I think, is to destroy presidential elections, which are due to take place on May the 25th, and to turn Ukraine essentially into a failed state.
Luke Harding is foreign correspondent with The Guardian. We have a few callers on the line, so let's hear from Andy in Redwood City. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose.
Hi.
Yeah, this is for Luke Harding. Just offhand, my grandmother, the fondest memory she ever had was delivering produce into Lviv in western Ukraine when she was a child. But other than that, could Luke tell us about the corporate interest that the United States has in the Ukraine that might be driving the neocon drive on this? I know the Chronicle did an article that had ExxonMobil and Chevron had interest. There must be others. Shell, I know, is there, too, doing fracking. So is this driving what brought in the coup d'etat that was done by the Western powers? Thank you.
Well, Andy, thank you very much for your question. I'm not sure I agree with the premise, because I really don't think it was a coup d'etat by the West, having met people who were standing around the streets of Kiev in minus 20, that they really weren't there as a neocon project. They were there because they deeply disliked this corrupt government I was just talking about, for Viktor Yanukovych. I mean, for sure, the West, I guess, has interest in Ukraine, but at the end of the day, I think Russia cares about Ukraine an awful lot more, and regards the country as being under its sphere of influence. And I think the problem for Putin is that essentially he wants a kind of client state. He wants a kind of government in Kiev which will be friendly towards Moscow and probably antagonistic towards the West. And what the West says, if you can use that term, is that it's possible to have both. It's possible for Ukraine to be a successful democracy with good ties with Moscow and good ties with the European Union. But Putin, in my view, sees the world in zero-sum terms. So he thinks what is good for the West is bad for Russia and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And so far, neocon agenda or not, I don't see a big neocon agenda myself. Putin is winning this game, hands down.
Why is Ukraine so significant for Russia? What are Russia's interests there?
I mean, there are huge. There are huge sort of industrial interests in the East, but I don't think it's so much about that with Putin. It's about Putin has this project where he thinks that basically all of the people left on the wrong side of the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, all of these Russian speakers should be brought under his dominion. And so he feels that Ukraine was never really a state, that these Russians should be part of the Russian Federation. He's already annexed Crimea, and I think the south and east of Ukraine are next. And obviously, if you live in Europe, if you live in, for example, the Baltic states, where there's a big Russian population in Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, you're regarding events in Ukraine very nervously, because obviously they're fearful that they may be next on the list.
What do you think is Putin's end game here? Do you think that he has a strategy, or is he kind of just going along as the days go by?
Rose, this is the problem we're talking about contemporary Russian politics, is that it very quickly it becomes sort of an exercise in criminology or almost Putinology, where you're just trying to peer into the president's head. And the problem is it's such a kind of vertical structure there. I mean, there's no Congress, there's no House of Representatives. The press is basically... state is a very subservient, and so really there's only one man who can answer those questions, and perhaps you should try and get him on your show.
That'd be nice. Well, tell us a little bit about the press there, because Putin gave awards recently to pro-Kremlin journalists for their, quote, objective coverage of the events leading up to the annexation of Crimea. He awarded medals of the Order of Service to the Fatherland to 300 journalists, including several editors, directors, and television hosts known for their Kremlin-friendly coverage, in an executive order signed on April 22nd that was not made public, but a Getty image was just released recently.
Well, I think it's deeply depressing, and it's a continuation of something that's been going on for a very long time. I mean, when Putin took power in 2000, the first thing he did was to basically kill off independent television, which had actually thrived in the 1990s, because he's someone who doesn't like criticism and feels that TV is the most important influence, the most important instrument of kind of sort of political manipulation, if you like. And the Russian media landscape was quite eclectic, but recently we've seen several independent websites. The editors have been fired. We've seen RIA Novosti, which is a big state-run news agency, but which occasionally had moments of independence, has also been shut down. And we've seen journalists basically being rewarded for behaving like apparatchiks, like civil servants, rather than sort of critical journalists. And the few people who have been critical of Russia's adventure in Crimea, I can think of a professor, for example, who wrote a hostile article about it, have been fired. And I think it's almost reached the stage where the sort of Russian media has become a kind of a sort of updated version of the Soviet media, essentially loyal to the state and giving the state's view of things, rather than the sort of, you know, critical body that it should be.
Luke Harding is an award-winning foreign correspondent with The Guardian. He's just back from eastern Ukraine, and he is the author of Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia. We'll also talk to him about his new book, The Snowden Files, later in the show. Speaking of cracking down on journalists and bloggers, The New York Times had a piece last week about Russia taking another major step toward restricting its once freewheeling internet. The lead in this piece says Putin quietly signed a new law requiring popular online voices to register with the government, a measure that lawyers, internet pioneers, and political activists said would give the government a much wider ability to track who said what online. Putin's action, just weeks after he disparaged the internet as a, quote, special CIA project, borrowed a page from the restrictive internet playbooks of many governments around the world that have been steadily smothering online freedoms they once tolerated. So this seems pretty significant.
Yes, Rose, I think that's right. I think that sort of Putin has woken up now to how important the internet is. Essentially, I would say for his first two presidential terms up until 2008, the Kremlin's strategy was to have all of TV under its thumb. So you turn on your TV, which was the main information source for Russians, especially for older Russians, and you see every day, regardless of what's happening in the world, the first story is Putin. What Putin did, who he met, shots of him nodding seriously, you know, across a desk, upbraiding a cabinet minister and so on. That was TV. But the internet was free. Mm. But obviously the internet has become more and more important in Russia. Connectivity has grown. Now, I'd say, I don't know what the latest stats are, but I would say at least sort of a half to two-thirds of Russians have got internet access. And so the Kremlin, which is a very risk-averse institution at the best of times, has decided it's time to stamp out bloggers and key voices. And so, for example, Alexei Navalny, who I would say is the main genuine opposition politician in Russia, a blogger with a huge following who's campaigned against corruption, he's been silenced. As of a month ago, he can no longer tweet or blog. And we've recently seen the founder of VKontakte, which is like Russia's Facebook, has left the country after essentially he was sort of pressured by the Kremlin. Really, the kind of the last sort of bastions of independent thought and independent thinking on the internet are slowly being shut down.
Well, how are people silenced? How does that work?
Well, I mean, this latest plan hasn't been enacted yet. So for the moment, you know, the internet still works. There are people I follow on Twitter, Russian writers who send very sarcastic, you know, bloggers and tweets and so on, but this is changing. This is changing, and it's kind of death by a thousand cuts. So, for example, there was a great Russian news website called Lenta.ru, L-E-N-T-A, with a great pioneering editor. 4 weeks ago, he was fired, and half of the journalists resigned in protest. There's a online TV station called TV Rain, which has done very good, proper, independent, decent reporting, and it was just yanked off most satellite frequencies, and so on. And so you can see the plan. The plan is basically to bring everything more or less under state control, which is very depressing.
Well, let's take a call before we go to break. Let's hear from Malcolm in San Bruno. Hi, Malcolm. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I'd like to express appreciation to your guest for his courage and going over there and getting this information and letting us know what's going on. I was curious if you saw any evidence of the CIA or other Western governments in trying to capture some of these Russian soldiers in keeping the news flowing about what's really going on. What about the flip side of what you see? You talked about what you see with Putin and the Russian KGB agents. What about the other side? Was there evidence of that?
Yeah, well, I hate to disappoint you. I mean, it would have been very exciting to have seen a CIA agent in Donetsk, but I, you know, I didn't. I only saw other Western correspondents who really were the kind of main conduit. I mean, I worked with reporters from the Washington Post for a week. A great guy called Bill Booth, who was their Jerusalem correspondent, and met their London bureau chief as well. So there are plenty of kind of brave journalists who are there. But in terms of sort of diplomatic presence, it's a bit dangerous, and most of the diplomats were holed up in Kiev. I mean, I do get still a daily diplomatic playbook from the State Department about what's going on, which is a sort of collation of news links and you know, what John Kerry is saying and so on. But for me, it felt rather remote because they were talking about this conflict, and it was clear to me on the ground that whatever America wanted, whatever its preferred outcome wasn't happening, because the number of men with automatic weapons and balaclavas on the streets was growing every day, was proliferating. So there may be things going on, I don't know, but it didn't seem to me there was much on a huge scale, at least not in the East.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Malcolm. And after the break, I will ask you about the U.S. role in this and, you know, what you think of what President Obama has said, because there's a lot of people are calling about, you know, the CIA's involvement or U.S. involvement. So I'd love to hear your take on that after the break. Luke Harding is a Guardian foreign correspondent and author of Mafia State. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin, general manager of KALW, here with Joe Burke, and I want to celebrate the fact that we have an hour where we can open up the lines and you can ask your questions of The Guardian's Luke Harding, of one of these foreign correspondents straight back from Ukraine, who can give real information and respond to our concerns and questions. That's what local public radio can do, and we do it with your support. We are celebrating here in our public radio party and asking you to join.
800, pardon me, 800-525- 9917 is the number to call. You can also join us online at KALW.org. And we have a wonderful thank you gift. I believe it's Luke Harding's latest book, The Snowden Files, for a pledge of just $120. Our phone room volunteers would be glad to tell you all about it. It touches on everything from concerns about domestic spying to the complicity of the tech sector. Join us now, 800-525-9917.
So that's at the $120 contribution level, but at any level, you will help us go towards the challenge we have for this hour.
Which is?
Garino DeLuca, a listener in San Francisco, said, I'm going to put forward $500, and if 20 KALW listeners, 20 people who appreciate the Media Roundtable and your call, call in or click 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. It's an additional $500, but it's got to be in this next
half
hour.
Now, you don't have to pledge the entire $500 to match that amount. It's however many, whatever you can give. We just need 20 people to join us. That's what KALW is really about here in the Public Radio Party. It's getting people to join us no matter what their level of comfort is in the way of a donation for local public radio. Here's the number you need to write down. Or, heck, punch it right now. 800-525-9917.
Garino DeLuca, a listener like you who appreciates this kind of thoughtful programming, he put his support forward. Just join him. That's what we're asking you to do. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Thanks to those folks on the line. We do have an open line. We're going to go back to the show.
800-525-9917.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll be joined by New York Times national correspondent Mark Leibovich. He'll be joining us to talk about his new book, This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. He writes about the United States ruling class's incestuous media industrial complex. You'll definitely want to tune in for this. And then on Tuesday, we'll be joined by Nomi Prinz, a writer who used to work on Wall Street, and now she's writing about banks and what really goes on Wall Street. Her new book is called All the President's Bankers. She writes about the very close ties between United States presidents and CEOs of banks. That's Tuesday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And we're joined by Luke Harding, an award-winning foreign correspondent with The Guardian, who's reported from Delhi, Berlin, and Moscow. He's covered the wars and occupations in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also Libya. He's author of Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia. He's also author of The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. And we'll talk about that in a little later in the show. Luke just returned from eastern Ukraine. So, Luke, because so many people are curious about whether the CIA is involved here, I mean, how would you answer that question? What role is the United States playing in this?
Well, they're clearly giving maximum diplomatic support to this new beleaguered pro-Western government in Kiev. So we've seen Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who's the interim prime minister in Washington. We've seen massive support from the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, Jeffrey Pyatt. But what we haven't seen, of course, is we haven't seen kind of beyond sort of sanctions. We haven't seen any sort of pledge to go any further. And I think, in a way, that's why Putin knows that really he can do more or less what he wants in the east of the country. I suspect, I mean, you mentioned Snowden. I suspect that the U.S. is probably providing the authorities in Kiev with all sorts of signals intelligence. In other words, they will be listening in on the pro-Russian separatists, and they'll be particularly concerned about what's happening in Slaviansk, which is this town I visited in the east, which has almost become the military headquarters for the separatist movement, where there are Russian soldiers and there are local separatists as well. But there are about 40 hostages there, and we had an American, Simon Ostrovsky, who spent 3 days there as a hostage. I'm sure they would have been across that. And we also had eight European military observers from the OSCE mission, who were also kidnapped and spent about 4 or 5 very uncomfortable days there. So I suspect that will be being fed back.
What did you hear from people on the ground, regardless of their loyalty to Ukraine or Russia? What are their grievances?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that's what underlies this conflict as much as anything, is that people are fed up with the standard of living in Ukraine. You certainly in the East, you get a lot of people who are nostalgic for the Soviet Union and think that life was better then. There was free healthcare, there were decent pensions. There was sort of self-respect, if you like, and they feel that the Ukraine has failed them. That there's massive corruption. It's very hard to make money. There are not many opportunities, and certainly in the east of the country, all of these traditional heavy industries like mining, machine building, steel plants, they've either collapsed or they are collapsing. They haven't really kind of kept pace with the modern world, and so there's high unemployment. And a lot of the people you speak to who are now with Kalashnikovs and wearing masks are from depressed small towns in the region, from places where coal mines have closed, where there are no jobs, where people are kind of living in poverty or near poverty. And I think this kind of insurrection is as much about economics as it is about politics.
And where are they getting, where are they getting the Kalashnikovs and just the guns and the clothing, and where is this coming from?
Well, again, that's a very good question. I saw something quite extraordinary about sort of 2.5-3 weeks ago when I was there. There was a group of separatists who managed to hijack 6 armored personnel carriers, which the Ukrainian military was using. Basically, an angry crowd surrounded them. The Ukrainian soldiers basically gave up and trooped off, and then they drove these APCs, wacky racist style, through the centre of town. I kind of followed them initially on foot and then by car because I couldn't keep up. And we ended up in Slavyansk. And they were, these APCs were flying Russian flags. And then when everyone was kind of calming down, I was talking to a couple of soldiers saying, where are you from? Where did you get your equipment from? Because they've got these guys had the latest kind of Kalashnikovs, very up-to-date weaponry. And they said, oh, well, we got them from the local police station. And I don't believe them. I talked to other people who said, look, I was in the police. We don't have guns that good. So I think the truth is that some certainly has come from inside Ukraine, from police stations, from the security agencies. But I think some has definitely come from Russia. And certainly in Slavyansk, the people in Slavyansk are essentially a Russian military unit from Crimea.
And going back to ordinary people, Luke, how is this really affecting people? What do they see in terms of their future? What do they think is going to happen in the coming months?
Well, people are very nervous that this was a stable part of the world. I still think that it may be possible for Ukraine to avoid civil war, because I think the forces in play, the guys with guns, are still relatively marginal. But people are anxious. They want what people want everywhere. They want decent jobs. They want healthcare. They want their kids to find good schools. They want a country which is free of corruption. They want decent leadership. It has to be said that the political class in Ukraine has been pretty terrible, not just Viktor Yanukovych, but previous leaders. Yulia Tymoshenko wasn't so great. Yushchenko, the former president, was also pretty incompetent. And so they feel let down by the political elite, and they feel that other countries have advanced. If you look, for example, to the north, to Poland. Poland is Europe's great success story. It joined the European Union in 2004. It's got a dynamic economy. It's a fully-fledged democracy. It's moved at an incredible speed since the communist years. And Ukraine, by contrast, is like the slow kid at the back of the class who's really going nowhere. And people feel this. They want something better.
Luke Harding is an award-winning foreign correspondent with The Guardian, author of Mafia State, How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia. He's also author of The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. And if you have a question for Luke about the reporting that he's done in Russia and Ukraine, he just got back from Ukraine, or if you have any questions about what's happening on the ground, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If there was a story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, we'd also love to hear about that. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Luke, because Putin is visiting Crimea for the first time. This is now leading the news today. We're hearing quotes from people saying that a civil war is looming. Do you agree with that? Do you think Ukraine is lurching toward a civil war?
I don't. I don't think it's lurching towards civil war. I think the situation is very tense. But I think, to be honest, what's been happening in the East, what I witnessed was certainly an uprising which enjoyed some local support, but not, I wouldn't say universal local support, sort of pro-Russian uprising. But essentially what we're seeing is a kind of multifaceted Kremlin operation to cause mayhem and chaos. And it's been quite successful, I think. And so we've seen this hijacking of civic buildings where gunmen have gone in. And, you know, and I've talked to them, and some of them are more sophisticated, but most of them, I have to say, haven't got a, you know, they haven't got a kind of clear political vision of what they want at all. And some of them appear to have been hired, I think. And one can't prove that, but that was certainly kind of my impression. And so I think, you know, if you could remove some of the weapons from the equation, I think there wouldn't need to be a civil war, because actually, as I said before, most people want the same thing. They want sort of decent services. They want a kind of decent life. But the problem now is that we've got to this stage where Kremlin information, you know, Kremlin propaganda is at maximum volumes. One of the stories I covered when I was there was that the TV station was hijacked in Donetsk by masked men with balaclavas and automatic weapons. And they basically turned off Ukrainian TV, which they said lied. And they replaced it with sort of Russian state propaganda, with Russia 24. And this has been the pattern all along, that Russia knows that the information people get is very important in shaping opinions and creating stories, creating narratives. And now, basically, most of the East of Ukraine is watching Kremlin propaganda.
We have an email from Doug in Santa Cruz who says, Terry Gross, she hosts a show called Fresh Air, had a guest on several weeks ago who said that the Ukraine and Crimea interventions were a way to distract the Russian public from the $50 billion corruption in Sochi during the Olympics. What do you think of that, Luke?
Well, Putin's opinion poll ratings are sky high. They've never been this high. I think the latest poll puts his approval ratings at 82%. This sounds like a kind of roll call of bad news, but another thing which I find somewhat depressing is that my Russian friends are saying that the atmosphere now in Moscow has become unbelievably patriotic, unbelievably nationalistic, and that even people who were sort of previously liberal or skeptical of Putin are delighted by the annexation of Crimea, are really kind of rolling with this kind of wave of national enthusiasm. And of course, you know, small victorious wars traditionally in history distract populations from other problems. Russia's problems, of course, continue. But for the moment, there's a feel-good factor in the air. As I said before, Putin today in Crimea is again talking about the Second World War and recasting the conflict in Ukraine as a sort of rerun of the Second World War, a struggle against fascism. And for the moment, you have to admit, whether you're a fan of Putin or a foe of Putin, that the overwhelming majority of the Russian population are with him.
Well, thank you for the email, Doug. Let's hear from Todd in Carmel. Hi, Todd. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hi. It's a great discussion.
Thank you.
What I find most compelling is the propaganda from both sides, that we're not getting the real truth about any of this. Like, your guest is apparently an apologist for the New World Order, and Putin is obviously an autocrat. And if you find that amusing, I think it's interesting that where was the charge of the Light Brigade? 1865. What was it?
Yeah, do you want me to come back?
Please, go ahead, Luke.
Well, I don't think I'm an apologist for the New World Order. There are very many, many things I'm unhappy about, both in my own country, and obviously I've just written a book which is enormously sympathetic to Edward Snowden and lifts the lid on US surveillance. So there's plenty to talk about here. It's merely that I don't think I don't think these things cancel each other out. In other words, you can be a critic of the Obama administration, of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but at the same time, you know, if Russia invades a sovereign country, that then, I mean, I've lived in Russia and I know where Russia is heading, and you know, I think we should be free to criticize that as well. But obviously, if you think that makes me an apologist for the New World Order, that's your opinion, of course.
And
you're welcome to it.
Well, thank you for calling, Todd. I mean, Edward Snowden going to Russia, how do you think that has changed public opinion of Russia and Putin, especially from people in the United States?
Well, I think just to be clear, my newspaper, The Guardian, has been a big supporter of Edward Snowden. We've written, I'd say, more than 400 articles about it. We jointly, The Guardian US jointly with The Washington Post, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize for public service for our Snowden revelations recently. So I feel that Snowden has done an invaluable public service, both for Americans and indeed for an international audience. And I think he's an extremely brave individual. Having said all that, I think the fact that he's in Russia is unfortunate. It would have been better for him, for his kind of his story, if he'd ended up in Latin America or in Iceland, or I think the best place for Snowden would have been Germany, if he ended up in Berlin, a good democratic European country. So I think his situation is tricky because he has 1 year's asylum from the Kremlin that expires in early summer, and obviously he would like to come back to the United States, but he doesn't want to spend 50 years in jail. There's no deal being offered to him at the moment by the White House, which still seems pretty vengeful. And so, for better or worse, Russia is his only option, and it's not a great option.
Last month, President Vladimir Putin held a national phone-in conversation, and Edward Snowden called in and asked, quote, "Does Russia intercept, store, or analyze in any way the communications of millions of individuals?" And Putin replied, quote, "Our intelligence efforts are strictly regulated by our law. We don't have a mass system of such interception, and according with our law, it cannot exist," end quote. What was your reaction to Snowden asking Putin that question? Jillian York, the director of International Free Expression at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, she tweeted, quote, "Snowden's question was softball. If he knows as much as he claims, he would have known that the wording gave Putin an easy out." What did you think of it?
Well, it's a tricky question to answer. I mean, I think Putin, he knew that Snowden was going to appear. I think it possibly wasn't a great decision to appear on that show, but Snowden wrote a very articulate piece afterwards explaining why he'd done it, which we, The Guardian, published, basically saying that he wanted to draw attention to the fact that it wasn't just America which was doing intrusive surveillance, but he wanted to sort of turn the spotlight onto Russia itself. And moreover, that he wasn't terribly impressed with Vladimir Putin's answer. And I think that's right. I think that's a reasonable place to be. I mean, as ever with Putin, his answer was a kind of half-truth. But actually, the system in Russia is, I don't think it's on the same scale as the NSA, but if the FSB, the spy agency, wants people's emails or phone data, they just have to go before a judge, and the internet companies, the telephone companies, are not even told. So in the US, they're told, they say they don't like it. There's a sort of FISA court procedure, and the data goes to the NSA. In Russia, they don't even know about it. And certainly when I was there, my email was hacked. My phones were bugged. And what was kind of curious about my experience of surveillance in Moscow was that it was demonstrative. In other words, the KGB, the FSB, they let me know that they were listening. And so very often I'd be on the phone, I'd say something, I'd talk about Putin and corruption in the same sentence, the line would be cut, and then I'd just get like this, I'd redial, and then, you know, I'd say something else that my whoever was listening didn't like, and then I'd get And sometimes this has happened, you know, 5 or 6 times on one call. Wow. So you start making jokes about it. Mm.
Luke Harding is an award-winning foreign correspondent with The Guardian, author of The Snowden Files, the inside story of the world's most wanted man. You talked about Snowden writing a piece about the question he asked, and he wrote, "I expected that some would object to my participation in an annual forum that is largely comprised of softball questions to a leader unaccustomed to being challenged. But to me, the rare opportunity to lift a taboo on discussion of state surveillance before an audience that primarily views state media outweighed that risk. I hope that Putin's answer, whatever it was, would provide opportunities for serious journalists and civil society to push the discussion further." So has the discussion about this changed much in Russia? I mean, it's not like journalists haven't been wanting to write about this. The question is, can they?
Well, they can, and I think Snowden is right insofar as it, certainly the people did talk about it, that the Russian system is called SORM, S-O-R-M, and suddenly there was quite a lot of attention on SORM. There are journalists who highlight this. There's a fantastic journalist who I'd like to commend, a Russian journalist called Andrei Soldatov, who's written a great book about Russia, about surveillance and about the FSB, called The New Nobility. The new nobility being the spies who basically have been running Russia since Putin took over in 2000 and occupy practically all of the sort of senior government posts. I would say a half to two-thirds are either ex-KGB or have some kind of intelligence connection. There is a kind of conversation going on. But the problem is inside Russia, to be honest, civic space has been so squashed. State media is, as I say, most media is state media. I don't really think that this has kind of taken off in any meaningful way, but certainly it's highlighted the issue more than it was highlighted before.
What is next for these revelations? Because we've had your colleagues on the show who said that when you look at all the documents that Snowden handed over to The Guardian, is it about 5% of the information has been published at this point? Is that right?
Yeah, it's actually, I think it's probably smaller than that.
Wow.
In fact, I don't know for sure. To be honest, there are different data sets out there with different people. So it's hard to be kind of definitive. But
we're talking like almost 2 million documents, and a tiny percentage have been printed.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it is as high as 2 million. I mean, the figure the NSA has used is 1.7 million, but Snowden has denied that and said that that's all of the data that he ever was in contact with. What I can tell you, I mean, certainly the stuff I saw, which was from the British spy agency, GCHQ, which works very closely with NSA to the point where they're practically siblings, that data cache was 55,000 documents. And of those, we published a small amount.
And are Guardian reporters reading these documents still? Or can we expect more revelations to come?
Well, I think there will be more revelations, but probably not at the kind of extraordinary speed that we were rolling them out last summer, because we were worried about Snowden, our source. We were worried about legal action from the British government. And of course, I don't know if your listeners know this, but we were forced to offshore our reporting operation to New York because we have no First Amendment in the UK. And we were basically being bullied and threatened last summer by the British government that wanted to shut down our Snowden reporting and take our computers away. And in the end, we had to smash up our laptops last July in an underground car park of The Guardian, watched by two middle-aged spies, from British spies from GCHQ, who took photos on their iPhones. And eventually, after 3 hours of bashing and sweating and deconstruction, they went back to Cheltenham, which is a provincial town in the UK where the British spy agency is based. So, it's been reporting on this material has been both, you know, there have been comic elements, but it's also been quite chilling. It's not been a great moment for press freedom. And I have to say, we do kind of envy you your First Amendment.
And Luke, in about 30 seconds, how has this affected British journalists? Are they weary about leaking this kind of information now for fear that their computers might be smashed? Or are they continuing to pursue this story?
Well, we're continuing to pursue the story. It's the most significant story I ever worked on. I think it's changed the world. But what we do is we've changed our methods. So for example, if we have a sensitive discussion, iPhones are banned. We go and meet in a broom cupboard somewhere. We've all got better at encryption. We all use PGP. We've changed our methods. The editor-in-chief of The Guardian US was given a cocktail shaker by her lawyer. If you put an iPhone in a cocktail shaker, it's quite hard for the NSA to bug it.
Wow.
Or a microwave is good. Snowden dinner table was a fridge. Wow. So we it sometimes feels like you're living in a badly written spy thriller. Mm. But of course, you know, we carry on.
Well, it's an amazing read. And Luke, I just want to thank you again for joining us. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. Luke Harding is author of The Snowden Files. I'm Rose Aguilar, and thanks for listening.